the four corners of Southern California. This is the Hot Seat and You're In It with me, Max Schwartz. It starts right now. Today on the phone as the first guest of 2014, I have senior scholar for the Wilson Center's Congress Project, Don Wolfensberger. How are you, Mr. Wolfensberger? Thank you very much for taking the time.
Doing wonderful. Good to be with you, Max.
Thank you. It's very good to have you, and thank you very much for taking the time out of your Friday afternoon to call in. Before we start, though, I would like to tell everyone listening that I have a lot of great and excited guests scheduled this semester, and because it is an election year, candidates from all different races will be calling in at the end of March and the whole month of April to be our pre-primary blitz. I would also like to apologize for ending abruptly last semester. So we have a lot to cover, so without further ado, let's get started. And before we start, before we get into talking about Congress in general, I would like to start with yesterday's announcement of the retirement of Congressman Henry Waxman of California's 33rd District. So first of all, Mr. Wolfensberger, was this a surprise to you, and do you think it will be now more difficult for Dems to win back the House?
Yeah, it was a surprise to me. I don't think Henry Waxman's retirement announcement is going to affect the Democratic race one way or another, because I think he is from a fairly safe district in California. So, I was surprised to an extent, but at the same time, when you see that his colleague George Miller from the same class, the 1974 class of Watergate babies, announced his retirement about 2 weeks ago. Well, then this makes a little sense. They're both ready to move on.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about George Miller, and there has been a large amount of Democratic retirements. And Henry Waxman, before he retired, was going to be the most senior member of the California congressional delegation, and he was going to be the only one left from the Watergate era. So
that's right.
I would like to ask you now, do you believe that all these retirements are being spurred by the polarization that we see in Congress and the refusal of Republicans to work across the, or of most Republicans to work across the aisle and believe in climate change?
I don't think that this is an unusual number of retirements so far. I've counted 17 members who are announcing their retirement. Now, there are another, I think, 14 members who have announced they're running for other offices, whether for the Senate or for governorship. So, you know, there's always a degree of frustration among those who say that they're retiring and they've had it with the House, but I really don't think it's an unusual number.
Okay, and one more question about this is, what does this mean for the Energy and Commerce Committee?
Well, I think it'll be a big loss from the Democrats' standpoint, in that Henry Waxman has been known, not necessarily as Mr. Energy, certainly Mr. Healthcare, which is another, you know, big jurisdictional piece that the Energy and Commerce Committee has, but he's also been very good on oversight in the Congress, both in his previous role as chairman of the House Oversight Committee, but also as a member of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. So, you know, I think it'll be a big loss for Democrats to lose him both as a legislator, especially on health care matters, but also as a person who is an institutionalist and understands that Congress has to exercise a very close oversight of the executive branch, regardless of which party is in charge of the White House.
Do you think that because of his loss as being chair of the Safe Climate Caucus and his extreme role in getting health care passed, do you think that either of those, whether it be climate change awareness or changes to the health care law, do you think either of those could happen now because he will not be there?
Well, there's always going to be somebody that steps up to the bat and becomes the new, you know, champion of the causes for which some other member who's retiring has championed over the years. So, you know, I don't think that's going to be a problem because people are always willing to step up and fill in gaps where experts move on and retire.
Okay, and now I'd like to talk about Congress as a whole, and you've spent many years in and with Congress, both as a staff member and as a scholar and researcher. So has the 113th Congress been one of the most partisan you have ever seen?
I think it's partisan from the standpoint of the two parties not being able to reach agreement on things, to not find middle ground, and I think a lot of the, you know, political science studies that look at votes and try and classify members as ideologically right or left or whatever show that, you know, this Congress is probably the most polarized ever. I think it depends on how you define partisanship. I think one way to define it is if the two parties can't agree and you're getting very little legislative things done, well, then that is one way of looking at partisanship, that there's sort of a neutralization going on between the parties, and that's partially because we have divided party government as well between the White House and the House and the Senate. So, you know, I would say that, yeah, there's a lot to be said that this is one of the most partisan Congresses ever.
Now, do you believe there's any prospect of that changing, or do you think the 114th, or I should say the 114th, or do you think the 114th will be similar in terms of polarization?
I think what I am hearing now is some members, even in this second session of the 113th Congress, saying we've got to do a better job of finding common ground on some things, that there's no reason that we should be disagreeing on almost everything. So there's already that kind of discontent in both parties, and I think that kind of bodes well for the next Congress, because I think they're picking up on the public vibrations, that the public is certainly disgusted with Congress, with an approval rating for Congress of around 13% or whatever. It's about the lowest I've ever seen it, and I think it's the lowest Gallup organization has ever registered it. So, you know, I really do think that there's going to be a change in attitudes, and that there'll be a little bit more done both in this session as well as probably in the next Congress.
Would you say that There is work being done, because all the media covers is the partisan bickering and one party blaming another, or are there backroom deals happening?
Yeah, there is work being done. I think where you're seeing it done is in these ad hoc gangs in the Senate and the House, where they're trying to put together things on, you know, immigration and other matters, where, you know, they are not necessarily working through their committees at this point because they're still a little leery of offending the party leadership. But I think that that is a sign that members are going to move forward anyway on certain issues where they can find colleagues on the other side of the aisle that want to work with them and get some things done.
Yes, and that's very true, as we saw with what happened with the Budget Committee between Paul Ryan, or the Select Budget Committee between Paul Ryan and Patty Murray.
Sure.
And would you say, I mean, you've got one party blaming the other here, and at least from the way the media covers it and from my perspective, it seems like one party is essentially less likely to work with the other party. Would you agree with that, or would you believe there's a mutual disagreement?
I think the Republicans at least have been more vocal about really not wanting to compromise, that you've got a new group in there from the last 4 years or so, the Tea Party members, who think that compromise is a dirty word and don't really understand that Congress means a coming together, and the whole idea of politics is to find a way to work out differences and get some things done. So, you know, there is a core group of members, and I don't think it's a majority of the Republican Party in the House or the Senate, but a core group of members who really would just as soon not see anything done. I mean, their idea of government is no government.
Okay, and we'll talk about the elections and the congressional to-do list a little bit later on, but I want to right now stay on the topic of Republicans, because the Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2014, which is the bill that keeps the government open, was written by Congressman Lamar Smith of Texas, who is a Republican, but both Democrats and Republicans have co-sponsored it. Do you believe this is a Republican bill that happens to keep the government open, or a bill that keeps the government open that has a lot of Republican ideals?
This is really a bipartisan bill, and I think it's a little deceptive. If you look at the bill, H.R., I think it's 3547, that was introduced by Lamar Smith, that has nothing to do with consolidated appropriations. That was a bill that extended the deadline for applications on licenses for commercial space launches. What that was that bill that passed the House, was out of the Science Committee, went to the Senate, amended, and they just used that as a shell to put the consolidated appropriations on. So the original bill had nothing to do with consolidated appropriations, but when it got back to the House, then Hal Rogers, who's chairman of the House Appropriations Committee, had this huge amendment in the nature of a substitute, which was the compromise that was worked out with the Senate, and that's what eventually was signed into law.
Okay, thank you for clarifying. But to be clear, that is the bill that is keeping the government open. It's just, it transforms.
It is. Oh, yeah, that keeps the government going for the rest of this fiscal year. So right up until October 1st, when the next fiscal year begins, this consolidated appropriations bill funded every single agency of government.
And I think that this bill, based off the way you're explaining it, is a perfect example of how things get so complicated and convoluted in Congress, and how so many changes there are to legislation.
Sure. And I think that's because it's more difficult to get your arms around a bill that is, what, 1,500 pages and covers every agency of the government and is, you know, billions and billions and billions of dollars. And it's the type of thing that Ronald Reagan said he was disgusted with when he slammed one of those 14-pound bills down on the lectern during one of his State of the Union messages. But it's the way that Congress has been doing business, unfortunately, the last several years when they can't get their act together before the new fiscal year begins.
We'll talk about the State of the Union in a moment, but what are your thoughts on this bill? Do you think it's a good bill, bad bill, things? What are your thoughts?
I think it's a good sign that at least the two sides were able to agree on an overall funding level in the budget deal that was done last year that paved the way for this, so that instead of talking a very low spending ceiling that the Republicans had in their budget and a higher one the Democrats had and the president had, they at least had agreed on a common number for not just 1 year but 2 years, and that budget bill last year. And so that's made it a lot easier then to reach the smaller agreements on the individual pieces, which is, you know, 12 regular appropriations bills all bundled into one here, but they were able to work that out.
Okay. And from what I read, and correct me if I'm wrong, the Keystone pipeline was mentioned in this bill. Do you think that's appropriate to be in this bill?
Well, I'm not sure what I don't recall the exact language. They did not, in this bill, give final approval and override the president's authority, but I think there was language in there that was sort of hortatory in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I personally am one that anything about a project such as Keystone should wait until the permit gets to the Secretary of State's office and the president's office.
And I think that's going to happen. I mean, I don't think the president would veto, obviously, anything that overrides his authority as he sees it.
I agree with that as well. And quickly, one question on the State of the Union is, what are your thoughts on the State of the Union? What do you think that says?
I was, sort of encouraged by the president's upbeat attitude. I think he was trying to put, the best face on things, and there is a good news story there in terms of the economy slowly recovering. We just saw some figures out today that the last year was much stronger than people thought in terms of the economy, and the president was not able to include that particular fact in the State of the Union, but he reminded me a little of the Reagan second term campaign, where it was Morning in America, and when the president opened up with those little vignettes about people getting up in the morning and kissing their wives and going to work and so on. You know, it was kind of reminding people that our country is really about the average working folks that do their jobs regardless of what's going on here in Washington.
Okay. And I know that you talk about the economy, and I know that the president will take the numbers as he sees them, but do you believe that these numbers actually represent people are getting jobs, or do you think it's just people stop looking to work?
There are more people getting jobs, but I think that and part of it too is that some people are not looking for work, and so that contributes to a lower unemployment rate. But I think overall that more jobs are being added slowly, but I think that you still see in any public opinion poll that I've seen people very much unhappy with the rate of economic growth and the rate of job creation, and that they still see the country on the wrong track because of that.
Okay, and it is a lot slower than what it needs to be given the amount of people unemployed. And as I said, we're going to move now to the congressional to-do list for the year. And do members of a certain party, in your opinion, do they not have the conscience and believe that much in their beliefs that they would put stopping a program that does not have funding ahead of helping the American people, the people who put them in D.C. in the first place? And this, of course, is referring to the Republicans and the unemployment insurance extension.
Oh, that's what a certain party is, huh? You said conscious. I think they are conscious. They're awake. Conscience, I think, is the word you're looking for. And I think what you're asking is, are you without a conscience if you think you have to pay for programs that you are supposedly funding? If you're not funding them, then you're adding to the debt and the deficit. So I think that is where the Republicans are coming from and saying that the unemployment benefits should be paid for. That's called pay-as-you-go. And that's what we do with most entitlement programs under pay-as-you-go rules. Now, they can set that aside if they say it's an emergency, and that's in the eyes of the beholder. But even Harry Reid was willing to entertain some amendments, although they had to set that aside because they weren't getting the 60 votes to overcome a filibuster. Mm-hmm. But even he was agreeing to allow for some amendments that would provide pay-fors for, you know, extending unemployment compensation.
But do you believe that they believe this strongly in their beliefs that they're willing to cut off, or what are your thoughts that they believe this strongly in their beliefs that they're not willing to extend aid for these people who are in good faith looking for work?
Well, I think I think they want to extend the unemployment compensation for people who are looking for work, and I indicated that they want to pay for it as well.
Okay.
So it's not like they're saying let's throw people out in the snow. They're saying let's pay as we go.
Okay. And do you think an unemployment insurance extension will ever be passed?
I think so.
Before the end of the session?
Oh yeah. I tend to be an optimist, but I think that they're going to work out an agreement where there are some pay-fors, and so the parties can agree that this should be done.
And another item on the congressional to-do list, one that they haven't really taken action on yet, is the immigration reform. And John Boehner has said he'd do it piecemeal, and Kevin McCarthy last week said that he's open to options of making people who are here illegally legal, if not citizens. So do you think... In what form do you believe immigration reform will pass, if passed at all?
I think that Boehner's approach will be followed, and that they will take up incremental pieces of legislation. Although it's questionable now as a result of the retreat the Republicans are in the middle of right now in Cambridge, Maryland, because there was division in the ranks among the Republican caucus in the House as to whether they should even bring this up this year. I think Boehner and his leadership thinks it should be brought up, and there is about close to probably half the caucus that thinks that this is not a good time to do it in an election year. So there is disagreement on that, but I think that pro-immigration groups think that the Republicans are doing on the right track in terms of talking about legalization.
Do you think that the Speaker will do what he wants, or do you think he'll give in to the rest of the party?
I don't know. I think this is going to be the subject of ongoing discussions in the Republican caucus, and they will sort it out before bringing anything to the floor. The last thing they want to do is to have an embarrassing defeat of legislation that they have introduced.
Okay. And how much help do you think, if any, does Kevin McCarthy's support for an immigration bill that makes people who are here illegally legal, how do you think that helps any sort of bill or any passage?
Well, I think it does help because it moves in the direction of what the Senate has done in terms of a path to citizenship. They both entail penalties and other conditions for either citizenship or legalization. But I think that moves in the direction of the Senate, and that if they do get that through the House, that bodes well for finding some kind of an agreement with the Senate.
Do you think that they will ultimately include a pathway to citizenship?
I don't. I think that the House is going to be, if they get that far, will be drawing the line at legalization.
Okay. And another thing on the to-do list, at least on the Democratic side, is reducing the wage gap and income inequality between those on the bottom and those at the top. And one thing that the Republicans, one thing that the Democrats have made a campaign issue is fighting inequality. And we'll talk about this a little bit more, but I want to ask the question now. Is there anything the Democrats can do about this, or do you believe that they're just crouching behind an issue to avoid talking about problems?
Yeah, I don't think there's anything that the president can do other than about it himself, other than, you know, what he indicated in terms of the increasing the minimum wage for government contracts prospectively, in other words, new government contracts that come up. The Democrats can't do anything in the House without Republican agreement, and I think that what we're going to see is a difference of opinion on how we go about narrowing the gap of income inequality. The Republicans think the way to do it is to find ways to incentivize businesses to create more jobs, and I think some of the Democrats would like to see more government redistribution type of programs, such as the increasing the or extending the earned income tax credit to families that don't have children. I think right now it applies only to families that have children. But so, you know, there's going to be a difference on approaches, but I think the encouraging sign is that I think the Republican Party realizes that it has to be moving in the direction of doing something about this gap that is very embarrassing for the richest country in the world.
Do you think that a bill will be passed by the end of the session that addresses this issue?
I don't know. I think there'll be small-ball bills, whether initiated by the Democrats in the Senate or by the Republicans in the House, and they might find some agreement on some of those. I just can't get a good sense of it right now, but I think it's good that the national conversation has begun, and some of this will have to probably lapse over into the next Congress.
Okay, and continuing along the same lines of the to-do list, the president has made college affordability one of his top priorities this year. Do you believe Congress will have any say in that matter, or do you think he'll go to them, or do you think they'll pass a bill that addresses this issue, or do you think President Obama is going to do everything on his own?
Yeah, I'm not sure I haven't seen any specifics on what he's proposed there. I got the impression from the conference that he held at the White House last week with over 100 college presidents that he was, appealing that to them to find new ways and working with businesses, corporations, and others to find more scholarship money and so on that's available to low-income kids who otherwise cannot get into college. But I don't see a big expansion of, existing federal programs, whether it's the Pell Grants or the loan programs or whatever. I just don't see that happening realistically.
Okay. And the last thing I want to talk about is something at least the House has already done, and that is the current farm bill. Now, do you believe that this will pass the Senate given the significant cuts in the SNAP program?
The conference report was agreed to by the House this week, and I thought the Senate had already agreed to that. I could be wrong, but I think it is a bipartisan bill, and that I thought it was already on the way to the president. I could be wrong.
Okay, it may be. I apologize if I am incorrect.
Could be incorrect, too.
Do you believe, though, that this will give a serious blow to Congress's already poor public approval rating?
Why?
Because there are significant cuts to the SNAP program, which a lot of people depend on.
I don't think that is hurting Congress. I think what is being played out more is the fact that they finally got together on something, that there is a bipartisan agreement. And yes, there are some things that are taking the hits, but I think that overall it's better than what the Republicans had originally proposed, which was a much more drastic cut in the food programs for the poor.
Okay. And now moving on to a different issue, I want to talk about some individual members of Congress here. First is Senator Max Baucus of Montana, and he is being nominated because he's retiring. He's being nominated to be the U.S. ambassador to China. Do you think he will be a good ambassador to China?
I think he's a good person. He's obviously very bright. He's done a capable job as chairman of the Finance Committee and so on. But I am not aware of what particular foreign policy skills he might have, how well he might do there. It's kind of interesting because he, as he admitted in his own confirmation hearings, he's not an expert on China, which is a little bit of an embarrassment. At least John Huntsman, who of course was a Republican governor that was there before Locke, knew Mandarin and was considered an expert on China. But so this is it will be an interesting thing to watch. You wonder sometimes what this post to China is. I mean, Huntsman was considered a possible threat to Obama in 2012, and so he was taken aside. He still ended up coming back and trying to run for president, but he didn't do very well. But Baucus, on the other hand, was very vulnerable in his Senate seat, and so people think that the Democrats have a better chance of holding on to that seat now with some young blood coming in that might be more appealing to his constituency. So I'm not. It looks to me like more of a political move than a smart move as far as our relations with China.
Okay, and yes, my thought was the international affairs is because Baucus is an expert in the finance/banking field. And the other thing is he's a very strong man. And are you worried at all that he may bother the Chinese, to put it lightly, given his strength?
He could. By strong, I assume you are looking at two qualities that have shown up in his stewardship at the finance, which are persistent and stubborn.
Yes.
And he can be outspoken as well. But I think that, you know, he understands that when you're an ambassador, you have to tone down your rhetoric while certainly still standing up for the values that your country stands for and representing those. And so, you know, we have not been shy about expressing our concerns and our protests about some of the human rights abuses that take place in China. I'm just not sure how he will proceed on that, but I think that he's certainly going to represent the values of the United States.
Okay, that's very good insight. But and going back to your comment about confirmation hearings, Obama has been dealt a little bit of a blow this past few weeks because between what Baucus said and what his ambassador to Norway said, I think that shows what Obama's thinking in terms of appointing people.
Yeah. I think that, you know, you run into that problem. I think Hungary was another example. You have people that are, you know, big fundraisers and don't know anything about foreign affairs and end up being, you know, nominated for these ambassadorships, and sometimes I come back and bite. And John McCain has certainly been holding their feet to the fire and trying to explore how much they really know about the countries they're being sent to represent.
Yes, and I'm glad you mentioned John McCain, because I was going to say that he just stopped asking questions at one point, and he's the next person I want to talk to you about. He has been censured by the Republican Party of Arizona. What does this say? I have my opinions, but what does this say about the Republican Party in general, and what does this mean for him?
Well, I'm not aware of the until I saw that you were going to be asking about that. I wasn't even aware that he had been censured by the party. But there is, in many states now, a group of people that are in charge of the Republican Party who are taking a more purist attitude, and they refer to rhinos, Republicans in name only, when somebody dares to part ways with the party on a particular issue. And so this is not unusual for him. He's been considered a maverick almost from the day he came to the House, not just the Senate when he went over there. So, you know, I suspect he's going to weather this okay.
Okay. And I will say, though, that at least in my personal opinion, this shows what is wrong with the modern-day Republican Party, which is they want you to be so conservative, and they don't like it when you act liberal or try to cross the aisle. And to me, that shows what the problem is and why the Republicans have such a struggle getting their candidate elected to president.
Yeah, that's true of certainly of some Republicans. They have that attitude, and that is a guarantee that they will end up being a minority party forever if they are not more inclusive, more tolerant, and more willing to, you know, to include people under the big tent that don't always agree with them on everything.
Okay, and I've got two more questions for you because I know you have to run. The last one is on a specific member of Congress, that being Speaker House Boehner. Would you say that in all your years watching Congress, he is one of the weaker speakers you have seen?
Well, I've seen a lot of speakers. Carl Albert was considered weak by some, but he was a very shrewd person. Prior to him, John McCormick, I remember him. And he was considered by some a weak speaker, but again, he knew what the temperament of the House was and what he could do and what he couldn't do. And then, you know, you had stronger speakers like Tip O'Neill, and before McCormick, you certainly had Sam Rayburn, who gets, you know, high marks for being a strong speaker, and yet he knew that he had to defer to his committee chairman because they were really in the catbird seat back in those days. So, you know, it all depends on what the climate is. John Boehner has been dealing with a very tough group of members in his caucus that he has given a certain amount of sway to, and so let them have their way and see where it goes. He finally spoke out against what was going on when the government shutdown came back and bit the Republicans big, and he had predicted all along that would happen if they persisted in closing down the government. So, you know, I think every leader is really a delegate of their caucus. They are, you can say on the one hand, it'd be nice if they could be strong leaders and crack the whip and impose their wills on the members, but that's not going to happen, or they're not going to remain leaders of their party for very long.
Okay. Thank you for that insight again. And I've got a two-part question for you, and then I promise we're done. And that would be, one, do you believe Mitch McConnell, or part A, I should say, do you believe Mitch McConnell is going to lose or at risk of losing his primary? And part B is, what Senate races are you looking out for specifically?
Well, I don't think, from what I've read of the McConnell race, I don't think he's as threatened as maybe some in the Tea Party would like to think he is. He's got a Tea Party-backed candidate running against him, but I think McConnell will do just fine there. And other than that, I'm not, as I say, I don't handicap races, so I don't really have a good line on what some of the other races are to watch, and so I will not really comment on that.
Okay, and a follow-up to McConnell. Do you believe that if he gets past the primary, do you believe he'll lose to the Democrat?
No.
Okay. All righty. Well, thank you very much for joining me this Friday afternoon, Mr. Wolfensberger. It's been a pleasure to have you. And the Hot Seat After Hours starts right now. You can email the Hot Seat inbox at thehotseatwithmaxschwartz@gmail.com, or you can tweet me at MaxSchwartzTV. You can also read and follow my blog at maxschwartztv.blogspot.com. The Hot Seat now has a mailing list. To subscribe, you can email the Hot Seat inbox with subscribe in the subject line, and I will add you to our list. Thank you for listening. I hope you'll join me next time. And if there is no breaking news, the guest will be CNN Los Angeles correspondent Casey Wyan.